to kick this thing off. Can I kick it off? One, two, three, boom.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to your final episode for Period 3 of World History Class with Mr. Lutz. Today's episode, we will address the transition from Period 3 and into Period 4 by discussing the major shift that's about to take place, where we're going to see Western Europe begin to grow its power throughout the world. However, I think you guys really need to understand that this development is not something that is destined to always going to have happened. It's going to take a lot of larger global and regional processes to unfold as they did historically in order for world history to play out as it did in the next period that goes from 1450 to 1750 and even beyond, to be quite honest with you. But before we begin to get into these changes in the next period, let's just wrap our heads around the global context that shaped the way these developments would eventually emerge. So for the key concepts in this chapter in particular, you'll see on the website there's going to be fewer overall key concepts that really connect with this particular chapter. So what I'll do is try to give you guys like a narrative and you'll see where those pieces fall into place. We'll start by focusing on, so what we'll see around the year 1400 is there's just really not one dominant economic power in the world. So the question starts to emerge is who will become the next dominant economic power? And we'll move from there into the emergence of Western Europe on the world stage, and we'll start to see some efforts they make to explore the world beyond the Mediterranean. And then before we go, we'll just touch on what's going on in Oceania, kind of outside of the world systems that we've been talking about so far this year, and in this unit in particular. So the question of who's going to emerge in and around 1400. Prior to the 12th century, you know, what we've seen if we go back earlier in this unit, the Abbasid world had really started to decline as it faced invasions by different groups that we've talked about previously, the Buyids and then the Seljuk Turks. And then they're completely destroyed really by the Mongol invasion that we've just learned about that took place in Baghdad in 1258. And so from there, they're kind of driven even more into the ground when they're invaded by Tamerlane in the early 15th century, which just even further destroys the region. And it's in the wake of this that the Ottoman Turks begin to grow in power. So when we talk about the Ottoman Turks, some background. As the Mongols had invaded Central Asia, the people who were living there, known as the Turks, a certain segment of them at least, are forced to move into what's called Anatolia, or the Anatolian Peninsula, which is pretty much modern-day Turkey. It makes up a majority of that country today. And at that time, this was territory that had once been under the control of the Byzantines, but had since fallen into the hands of the Seljuk Turks by about the 13th century. And so eventually the Ottomans are going to begin to carve out territory of their own thanks to the conquests of Osman during the late 13th and early 14th century. And as this state grew, the inhabitants become known as the Ottomans, named for Osman. So by the end of the 14th century, by the middle of the 14th century, the Ottomans had expanded across what's called the Dardanelles Strait. And they used that. The Dardanelles Strait basically connects Asia and Europe. It's pretty much where Constantinople, or today's Istanbul, is located. And they're going to use that as a launching point for conquest in the Balkan Peninsula of southeastern Europe. So the Ottomans are to consolidate their hold over this region after much fighting, and by really the 15th century and the latter half, they're ready to seize control of all that remained in the Byzantine Empire, which is Constantinople. In 1453, they put Constantinople under siege, and ultimately it falls into the Ottoman Sultan Mehmed II. And this means the end of the Byzantines, an empire that, if we go back mentally, an empire that stood the test of time for more than 1,000 years. So Ottoman rule is going to expand throughout Asia and Europe, and it seems as if they're going to take the mantle as the most powerful empire in the world. And certainly, they are a major influencer on the world stage. And again, as this episode is doing, this is kind of setting up period four. So yes, we will touch on the Ottomans a lot more in the next unit. But one thing I need to stress to you at the beginning here is that their economic influence is not going to be the same as what we had seen in the Islamic world of the Abbasids. China is now more oriented into the global trade network, thanks in part to the resurgence of the Silk Road under the Mongols. So they're going to have something to say about becoming the dominant economic state. So transitioning out of the Ottoman talk and kind of into the Chinese, as the Mongols collapsed in China in the last episode, we saw the rise of what was known as the Ming Dynasty. And they're going to replace the Mongol Yuan Dynasty in 1368, and they're going to immediately set about restoring Chinese culture and Confucian values back into Chinese state and the Chinese state in everyday life. But they're also going to assert their control over the borders and establish control again over their neighbors of Vietnam and Korea and Tibet. And the key thing for this particular episode is they're going to also set about expanding their trade connections throughout the Indian Ocean. And this is where we get Admiral Zheng He. So Zheng He is an admiral of the Ming Dynasty who, beginning in 1405, starts to set out on voyages throughout the Indian Ocean to India, the Red Sea region, to East Africa, and really throughout the entire region. And the purpose of these voyages is to reestablish the Ming presence throughout the region, kind of say like China's back, China's restored to its former glories. It's also to assert Chinese supremacy over their immediate and regional neighbors by exchanging their goods. Primarily silk and porcelain are the two attention grabbers. And they're doing this in exchange for local goods, kind of like exotic animals is really the big drive there. They're really keen and interested in giraffes and zebras, which we're going to come back to. You'll see in a little bit here, but if that sounds strange to you, it probably should. But what the Chinese want in exchange for their goods is for these people to acknowledge Chinese superiority. And a real concrete and easy way for you to see Chinese superiority, or at least why the Chinese believed they were superior, is in the treasure ships that they used on these voyages. These ships are over 400 feet long, over 150 feet wide, and if you compare them to the ships of Columbus, as you'll see in your book, I don't have the book in front of me, but just look for the pictures of the ships and you'll know you're in the right spot. Anyway, using those ships and using the compass, it results in the Chinese really being able to establish their presence throughout the Indian Ocean trade network and really start to establish themselves as being the dominant economic force throughout the better part of the interconnected world, let's say. But the problem is that support for these voyages are not going to remain. And there's several reasons to this. First of all, when the Chinese emperor Yongle dies, so does support for these voyages, because he was a big fan of the voyages, had felt that they were worth the while of the Ming. But as he passes away, Confucian government officials, who, if you recall, have really always been skeptical of the merchant classes, really looked down upon these voyages and really tried to talk about what's problematic with these voyages so that they can end. They see them as being a waste of valuable resources, and they feel these resources can be better utilized to secure the northern border from the Mongol invaders, who still remain, just not in the same way that they did in the 13th century. But so much money is already being spent in this defense against the Mongols, and also, too, they're constructing a new capital city at Beijing. So in 1433, these voyages come to an immediate and abrupt end, and the treasure ships are going to be destroyed. Now, Chinese trade and Chinese merchants are still going to have a presence established in Southeast Asia, where you're going to see them influence the cultures of the Philippines and Malaysia and Indonesia. But it really must be stated here, China's going to really balk at that opportunity to take the reins as the dominant global economic power. And that really needs to be emphasized in this moment. So this, of course, then brings us to Western Europe. And so as the 15th century emerges in Europe, we really begin to see some changes on the horizon. The continent had been ravaged by the bubonic plague back in the 14th century, and as a result, among other reasons, it begins to see the decline of serfdom. Feudalism also began to decline as the warrior aristocracy loosened its power. They really don't have the same grip they used to, and monarchs are going to begin to consolidate their rule in more efficient ways. We'll see this particularly in the rise of the professional armies. And specifically, really, the first ones to emerge are going to be the monarchies of Portugal and Spain, who grow in authority and military strength, especially as they reconquer their land from the Muslims who had extended into the Iberian Peninsula that we saw back in the beginning of this unit. Specifically, the kingdoms of Castile and Aragon in modern-day Spain are going to be united by the marriage of Ferdinand and Isabella, which creates the monarchy of Spain. And if you have heard those names before, Ferdinand and Isabella, it's probably because you remember learning about them when they financed the voyages of Christopher Columbus at the end of the 15th century. So the Europeans had also been really fearful of Mongol domination and coming to their shores of Western Europe, so to speak. But in a way, Mongol domination of Central Asia has really helped them in the sense that it made Far East Asia and South Asia become more accessible for European trade. So as a result of this, Europeans are going to begin to learn about all the advancements coming out of Asia, and this is going to really help them, especially in their development of navigational tools and, quite frankly, the things that are going to help them to expand their reach globally with gunpowder weapons as well. Now, on the other hand, the reestablishment of Muslim control over the Holy Lands after the Crusades, and coupled with European tastes for foreign luxury goods growing as well, meant that prices are going to be going up for Europeans because they're losing their direct connection to Eurasian trade, and it has to go through Islamic, at a minimum also, Italian intermediaries. So what we start to see towards the end of this period is there's going to be a growing desire to find some type of overseas trade route that connects Western Europe to India. And this is really going to drive the efforts of the Portuguese and the Spanish. If you think geographically, as trade currently stands, they're really the ones who are furthest from kind of the centers of trade. And they're also the closest to the Atlantic. And of course, that's going to be the European bridge to the overseas trade routes to India. So with this growing internationalism regarding economics and culture, we begin to see the emergence of the Renaissance taking place in Italy during the 14th century. And this is thanks to really growing global contacts with the Byzantines, and even as the Islamic empires take control of the former Byzantine Empire, you get Byzantine refugees, basically, some of their top scholars coming into Italy, bringing with them their knowledge of the classical past. When we say classical there, we specifically mean the heritage and the culture of the Roman and the Greek worlds. And it might seem strange to you because you're like, well, Italy is where Rome is located. Why do they not have such a strong connection to their classical past? And the honest truth, and we've seen this already, is because those original manuscripts and documents that had emerged from this period, they've needed to be copied over the centuries. And really where that's happening at its greatest rate is in the Byzantine and especially in the Islamic worlds. So as those contacts are coming up then, there's where you see the rediscovery of the classical past. And so a growing interest in worldly and material pursuits are going to also emerge as trade expands and people begin to value life on Earth due to the fragility of life being exposed as a result of the uncertainty produced by things like the Black Death. The reintroduction of classical culture leads to a belief in human beings that they can improve themselves and they can ultimately improve the world around them. So this is going to be known as humanism, and there's going to start to emerge a questioning of supposed truths that had been told to people from the top down from places like the church and from kings and higher sources of power. So art and literature and music is going to focus away from religious themes and more towards the classical culture, toward humanist achievement and secular pleasures. And there's going to be a scientific and methodic approach to painting that's going to lead to the reemergence of perspective or creating three dimensions on a flat surface. But in all honesty, before I get too wrapped up in trying to tell you all these things about the Renaissance, it's really only beginning in 1450. And we're not going to see the most famous works from artists like Da Vinci and Michelangelo and Raphael until the end of the 15th century. So again, we're going to revisit this cultural development in the next unit. But I really do have to reemphasize to you, the Renaissance is going to emerge primarily due to growing commercial contacts between Italy and the larger world during the 15th century. Without this development, there's not enough of a cultural curiosity to stimulate interest, nor would there be an economic base to finance the development of the art, the architecture, the literature, and the music of the Renaissance that we really kind of consider to be so central to what we view as being the Renaissance. And so outside of the European cultural developments taking place, what we're starting to see also in the 15th century is that Europeans are beginning to sail out of the Mediterranean through the Strait of Gibraltar and into the Atlantic Ocean in search of that sea route that's going to take them to India. And this is going to be made increasingly possible thanks to navigational tools like the compass and the astrolabe making their way from Asia to help Europeans with overseas navigation, as well as improved map-making abilities. And also, too, we have to note that Prince Henry the Navigator of Portugal is going to help establish a navigational academy. And by 1450, this is going to help result in the Portuguese taking control of a Moroccan town, and also from there beginning to grow their presence along the West African coast. And by 1498, so again, going into the next unit, Vasco da Gama achieves that ultimate Western European goal at this time of being the first to sail around Africa and all the way into the West Indian coast in the year 1498. So there's so much that needs to be stated about what's going to come as a result of that, that obviously we're not even going to begin to touch on that, but just know that huge fundamental transformation is really, really close to developing here. And finally, to briefly address the one region that we have not yet discussed in period three, Oceania. So Oceania is still isolated during this time, which is why we haven't really talked about them. They're isolated specifically from larger Afro-Eurasian contacts. But let's try to establish where they are at the start of the 15th century. What we had been seeing in that region since the 7th century is the Polynesian people are expanding their settlement of the Pacific and their population in the region. And so trade by that point, by the 15th century, has grown within the region, and it's based upon the exchange of tools, of pottery, exotic goods like shells. And these trade connections are also going to lead to the establishment at times of interrelated social and political relationships between these different island groups, primarily thanks to the exchange of goods, but also intermarriage between these groups. Interestingly enough, sweet potatoes had spread through the region as well, so it's most likely that this came as a result of the voyages that have taken the Polynesians all the way to the coast of South America and back, where they returned with this food source for the betterment of their people. And this food had specifically become important for the development of the Maori people. So the Maori of New Zealand, to kind of jump ahead a tiny bit, had reached a population of 200,000 by the 18th century, and they had developed a complex society, keep in mind, in isolation from areas beyond Oceania. And here's what we're going to start to see happen, is that ultimately they are going to be decimated upon contact with the Europeans. And this is a result of really two factors: lacking immunities to European diseases and a flat-out inferiority when it comes to weaponry compared to the Europeans. So again, it's more foreshadowing than anything else, but I just wanted to give you some brief notes on what's going on in that region of the world at this time. So for the zooming in feature in this episode, I wanted to talk about the bubonic plague or the Black Death. It sometimes gets, relatively speaking, a small bit of attention in your textbooks because it's at its worst for a period of about 5 to 8 years in the 14th century, and then it fades, And it's really, that's too short of a time period to lend significant attention to in a world history textbook. However, the global impact that it has in that 5 to 8 year span and the long-term effects that it has are definitely worth discussing. So just a quick kind of factual overview of the plague for you. It most likely begins in the Caspian Sea region during the mid-1340s. Some people, some books will talk about it developing further west in China in the 1330s, but from the most recent things that I've read, it seems like it's Caspian Sea area mid-1340s or so, where we really see it start to spread and where some books will pick up its discussion is when the Black Sea port city of Kaffa, which was an Italian trading post, came under attack from the Mongols, who came out of the west from the Caspian Sea. When the Mongols attack Kaffa, the Italian merchants there flee that city and sail out of the Black Sea, through the Bosporus and the Dardanelles, and back into the Mediterranean, into Italy, bringing with them the plague on board their ships, because it traveled on fleas, or through fleas, I should say, on the backs of rats, and from there, it really begins to affect human beings. It's also believed that in some instances, too, the plague may have also traveled via the transmission of bacteria in the air, which, with the transmission from rat fleas, is going to lead to catastrophic human loss. So what the plague would look like is, in terms of symptoms, you would see swollen lymph nodes, which are going to be located on the side of your neck or underneath your armpits or in your groin. And these lymph nodes would not only swell, but they would also turn black and blue, which leads to the name then, the Black Death. And this disease could lead to internal bleeding. It does lead to internal bleeding, flu-like symptoms, and also for many, death is going to result within a matter of about 3 to 5 days. So the most evident impact of plague is on the population of the areas where it affected. To start with, China's population in 1300 stands at about 85 million people. So keeping in mind that 1300 puts you kind of smack dab in the middle of the Yuan Dynasty era. They had taken the Southern Song in 1279, won't be taken by the Ming till 1368. So population is relatively stable at that time. But by 1400, it's reduced to 75 million. And in that same period, from 1300 to 1400, Europe's population had gone from about 79 million to 60 million, which is a drop of almost 25%. Some cities or towns like Florence, Paris, London, Hamburg, Germany are going to lose approximately 50% of their population from 1347 to 1351. And it should go without saying, but this disease does not discriminate based upon your age, your social status, your economic status. And so resultantly, it has a large effect on entire societies to whom it was exposed. What we'll see are severe labor shortages in many agricultural and feudal societies. What this leads to then is that serfs are no longer available at a huge surplus. So now they're in greater demand. And what this means is now these serfs kind of transitioning out of that title because they are allowed to secure more rights. They can make more demands of the people whom they are working for. And they can even leave their land in search of better opportunities on estates that are more desperate for labor, or even in towns as they start to reestablish themselves and population starts to grow again, economic opportunities start to emerge in towns as well. And what this will lead to, it makes sense. For example, in England, is there's going to be a backlash against this emergence of rights. And so the monarchs, the nobles will kind of have a retrenchment of their power, and they're going to try to freeze wages. They're going to try to hold on to those vestiges of power that they had. And this then will lead to rebellions. We'll see the Peasants' Revolt in 1381, where serfs who were angered by the lack of reform since the days of the plague in the 1340s and 50s lash out against the ruling classes. Now this rebellion is going to be put down, but its demands, including the abolition of serfdom, establishing more freedoms and equality between the classes, are going to eventually come to pass in England, and they start to emerge now. And so going with that, the plague is going to start to affect the way that people view the world around them. They had been told that the church and that God is able to save mankind and able to help people endure the most horrific of human experiences. And now they witness a plague that seems to spare no one in particular, and it does not distinguish between any groups of the people. And the church is unable to really provide an explanation for this epidemic, nor are they able to make this epidemic go away. So people sometimes begin to, sometimes with reckless abandon, enjoy the pleasures of the world as opposed to focusing their energies on repenting and preparing themselves for the afterlife. So we start to see people reassess the value of this current life, and it's going to impact the course of Western European history, beginning, as I've previously mentioned, with the Renaissance and leading to things we'll talk about in the next period, like the Reformation. And we'll start to see a more identifiable worldview that you and I can relate to in our own contemporary world. So with today's explainer, I want to reemphasize to you guys that this chapter really just sets the stage, because 1450 is a pretty monumental period. I don't want to say a year, because I can't recall anything of particular importance that occurs in the year 1450, but in and around 1450, there are some major global shifts going on in terms of the balance of power. Specifically, for the people reading World Civilizations, at least in the fifth edition, on page 337, there is a section that's called Adding Up the Changes. And I don't have the book in front of me, but to summarize it very briefly, it's like, okay, so we start to see the emergence of Western Europe on the global stage. And this is not due to Western European cultural superiority nor genetic superiority. There's a lot of processes that are going on around the world that lead to this moment unfolding as it does. It's not the result, like I said, of something inherent in Western Europeans. It's world history leading to this moment in time. So this kind of brings us to a major controversy that had emerged in AP World History starting right at the end of the last school year. And what we saw happen was there was a proposed change to the curriculum of AP World History, which is still coming after this school year. But the original proposed change was to start the course no longer where we started, which we kind of just say is the kind of the quote-unquote foundations of civilization, with no particular year attached to it. They were going to start the course at 1450. And among a whole host of reasons that I'm not going to get into all of them right now, because you'll hear me just start screaming and banging my fist and yelling a lot. But simply put, 1450 is such a pivotal year because Western Europe is going to emerge at this point as being the predominant global power. It's not going to happen immediately. It's going to take time. It's going to be a shift. But a lot of places that we'll learn about from 1450 on will be discussed in terms of their relations with Western Europe. So when you start a course at 1450 and you don't have that backstory, the dangerous thing there is that you just assume that Western Europe has always been the predominant global power. And if there's something that we've seen in this class among, my goodness, way too many things to mention, is that Western Europe has been anything but a predominant global power. We've seen the Roman Empire has been very strong and durable and lasted a long time. But even the Roman Empire's focus was far more towards the east than it was to its Western Empire of Gaul and Britannia. And that's just not where the heart of the empire was. So starting a course at 1450 just has this really problematic nature of assuming that Western Europe is kind of the dominant force in world history, and that's just the way that it's been. But again, we have not seen that in this class. Now, 1450 won't be the starting point for next year's course. To our understanding, it's supposed to be 1200, but we really don't have a clear picture of what next year looks like. So I guess stay tuned for those details, but I would consider yourself lucky. I know it's a lot of information to learn in this course, and there's definitely things that could be improved within the context of AP World as it currently stands. But I don't think starting a course at 1200, especially not 1450, is the right solution to the problem. I think that there's too much value in the earlier history, and now a lot of classrooms are going to be missing out on that opportunity to learn of those great things. So for my recommendations, take a deep breath and a sigh of relief, because I think, in my opinion, you guys have pushed through the most difficult part of the course, in the sense that I think your reading schedule was busier in this particular unit than it will be or has been for any other part in the year. So you're past it. Enjoy your achievement. Enjoy your accomplishment. There's more to come, of course, but you've done something that's worth noting. So give yourself a pat on the back. You've earned it. All right, hitting that time, we're at 30 minutes, so I'm going to wrap it up and get on with the rest of my day. I hope you guys have a good one wherever you are right now, and I will see you soon. Take care, everyone.